Empire podcast this week, we sing because we're winning. An interview with Taron Egerton, who's the star of Sing, which is out this week. And we choose life, choose a sequel, choose Ewan McGregor over Piers Morgan, choose a bunch of unbelievable Oscar nominations and a Trainspotting film on the only movie podcast that will not be bringing you alt truth this week. Hello, Pod. I'm Helen O'Hara, and welcome to the Empire podcast. Chris is away today. He's hanging out with some celebrities on a film set. Or is he? This week, one reader asked us, and I quote, "How do we know for reals that you interview the stars, etc.? You could be making it all up." Well, Anon, as you signed yourself, maybe we are really that good at Photoshop and celebrity voices and makeup jobs for our alleged live guests and libel law. But honestly, what's the more likely scenario? This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning in an intro sentence that will never make sense to me. First up is a man who has never invented an interview with a celebrity, but who we're pretty sure exaggerated the enthusiasm with which Jennifer Garner once hugged him. It's James Dyer.
I resent that implication. It was very enthusiastic.
Uh-huh.
I like to think.
Well, QED, yes. Ladies and gentlemen, QED.
It was a little awkward. I may have held on for a little too long. I'm just saying.
You could take this chance to apologise to Jennifer Garner.
Sorry,
I'm
Jennifer,
sure she listens.
I didn't mean it.
And then we have a man who is desperate to prove that he exists and escape his existential conundrum. And the only way he can do that is by interviewing celebrities. So if they're also not real, then it's a real problem for John Nugent.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Oh, hey, yeah, I'm the embodiment of fake news.
My alternate truth is that you never saw The Rock and you were never in Hawaii and he never gave you tequila and you made it all up.
James, in a post-truth world, we can believe what we want.
All right, it's time to make like a White House press secretary and give simple, honest answers to straightforward questions. And this week, the question comes from at Dr. Huxton, who asks, which performance in a bad film or just undeserving of a nomination would you nominate for an Oscar? Now, by bad film, do we mean literally bad but with one good performance, or do we mean just the kind of film that doesn't get nominated for Oscars?
I don't know. I mean, my head immediately went towards like comedies.
Okay.
You know, because they never get a look in at the Oscars.
Yeah.
And it might have been because it was a classic scene in Empire recently, but my head very much went towards Jim Carrey coming out of a rhinoceros naked in Ace Ventura When Nature Calls. I think that is one of the all-time underrated performances. I mean, not just him exiting a vagina of a rhinoceros naked. Obviously, that takes a certain level of acting skill.
Point of order, Your Honour. It wasn't a real rhinoceros.
No. But I don't...
Oh, well, that's okay.
No,
then.
But even narratively, even in the film, it's not a real rhinoceros.
No, yes, yeah. Granted. But that doesn't diminish his acting prowess.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think Jim Carrey has really been overlooked across his career in the Oscars. Mm. I think some of his comedy performances are extraordinary and you know, he's giving it all barrels. I mean, there are no more barrels left because of all the barrels that he's giving in some of his films.
I'll be honest, I really like his understated stuff, like, you know, The Majestic,
yeah,
and The Truman Show in particular, just when he kind of dials it right down. He's actually phenomenally effective.
I think
actor.
It's not a bad film, so this is, again, going away from the question, but I think Eternal Sunshine, he was
oh my God,
that.
Yeah.
I think he really should have at the very least been nominated.
I don't know whether it's because you expect the kind of like rubber faced mugging and, you know, the gravitas kind of, it's a counterpoint to that, or whether it's just he's very good, but no, I love his dramatic stuff. Weirdly, much more than I like his comedy.
Yes, but you hate comedy.
I do hate. I'm an enemy of fun. It's true.
I mean, I would be worried personally about, you know, awarding people for you know, exiting large mammals, because that's a slippery slope to rewarding Grimsby, which and there I draw the line. I will not have that.
Yeah.
So yeah, but I take the point. I think you're right. I would personally think that that The Mask is the kind of performance that should absolutely be up there.
I'm gonna say, I see it's in bad movies, so I can't say Alan Rickman in Die Hard, because Die Hard is obviously the greatest action film ever made. So I'm gonna say Alan Rickman in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which is by any standard a bad film.
It's definitely a bad film.
He is magnificent in it.
Yeah, he is.
I think he's sort of he's elevated more by the fact that Kevin Costner is so bad in that film. I mean, when you're acting against someone who can't decide which accent to fall on, yeah. Then...
But that bad performance gave Cary Elwes a great line in Robin Hood Men in Tights. Unlike some other Robin Hoods, at least I can speak with an English accent.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. So...
Also, it enabled Brian Blessed to go, God and King Richard! And
actually, Brian Blessed in Flash Gordon, now that
hey.
Would be...
Gordon's alive!
That would be, you know...
Imagine that Oscar speech.
Okay.
Wow.
The reverberations would still be ringing right. around the world.
Do you remember back in, I want to say, like 2001, 2003, 2000, something like that, about 2002, 2003, we did a poll on the website to see which Hollywood celebrity our readers most thought resembled God. And they almost unanimously responded with Brian Blessed. And he, bless his little cotton socks, even gave us a response. And he wrote to us to say that he was very privileged to be the embodiment of the Almighty on Earth. this is the thing that actually happened.
I mean, he actually is, so yeah. that's fair. That's okay. Yes.
Tim Roth in Planet of the Apes.
Tim
really
Roth.
Good, genuinely really good as an angry chimp. I think he had a different name.
In the Tim Burton.
Yeah, he's really good in it. Like, it's, I mean, the film is almost unwatchable, but he is really good in that film.
Okay.
I've scrubbed the memory of that film out of my mind. The only thing I can remember is the epilogue at the end where they land back on Earth and there's apes in like police costumes. Which, you know.
Do you know what? I actually went to the novel adaptation of that in a bookstore and picked it up trying to figure out what the heck happened at the end. And they just left that ending off completely. It's not in the novelization.
Really?
Yeah. So it was obviously like a last minute idea that somebody came up with, and it's the worst. A film undeserving of a nomination is patently She's the Man with Amanda Bynes. But I think she's great in it. She's so charming. If that was like a sort of serious Oscar-y film, she would 100% have been nominated. That's the sort of the riff on Twelfth Night, where she pretends to be her own twin brother to go to school because she really wants to study soccer with Channing Tatum. and basically in this version of reality, you can't really play, I'm putting it in air quotes here because I'm in the UK, soccer football without being able to bicycle kick over your head. Like, that's like an essential skill that everybody needs to have.
That's my understanding of the sport, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's her big thing, that she has to learn how to bicycle kick over her head, and they have like a whole training montage where he's teaching her to do that. It's unbelievably ridiculous, but I kind of love it.
I've not seen She's the Man, but I quite like to now. That sounds brilliant.
I haven't either. I also like the guy in that new film who plays the leader in, I think it's called The End of the World, and, you know, the fascist dictator who takes over, and it's a whole thing. He's very compelling, a little two-dimensional.
Yeah. I don't think anyone really buys that, though, do you? I think we better stop there before we get to
hashtag
the
politics.
Yeah.
Moving on.
So if you want to get your question read out on the Empire Podcast and treated with exactly this amount of analysis and insight, you can put it on Twitter. We are at Empire Magazine, and you'll need the hashtag Empire Podcast. We are on Facebook at Empire Magazine again, and you can email us at podcast@empireonline.com. But enough of these non-famous voices. I think it's time for a guest. And this week we're joined by Taron Egerton, star of Kingsman, Eddie the Eagle, and now Sing, wherein he plays a gorilla with the voice of an angel, or at least the voice of a Kingsman. He was speaking to Chris. Enjoy.
Delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the star of Sing, Mr. Taron Egerton. How are you, sir?
I am all the better for seeing you, my friend. It's
lovely
to see you.
Oh, you know exactly what to say, just to butter me up right at the beginning of the interview.
I do. I know you too well, clearly.
Then it's going to be soft questions for the next 20 minutes.
Yeah, that's the hope. That was the plan.
What first attracted you to the project? I'm not going to start with that. That's a nonsense question.
It is.
But one that I've had a lot today.
Anyway. Yeah. What other questions have you had a lot?
So what other questions have I had a lot? Do you know what? People are... they've been great today. Lots of innovative, kind of very lovely, lovely questions.
Oh, shit. Really, I've got nothing.
We're here for a chat.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, how have you been?
Having a pint.
What have you been up to? What have you been doing?
Yeah, well, I mean, so I guess last year, I mean, I saw you on the set of Kingsman 2.
Yeah.
That was the last time I saw you.
Yeah.
Since then, what have I done? I had a sort of summer of enjoying myself after that, or what was left of the summer. And then some Kingsman pickups, lots of promoting this toward the end of the year, and I'm now in pre-production for Robin Hood. We start shooting next week.
Next week?
Yes.
Okay, so you okay? You proficient with a bow and arrow?
I'm good with the bow and arrow, yes. I'm getting there. horse riding is proving something more of a challenge, but I'm sure I'll get there as well. It's really, really fun, and it's shaping up brilliantly. Otto's an incredible, really quite incredible man, and yeah. The cast is awesome. It's going to be fun, I think.
So this is not a swashbuckling, it's not Errol Flynn?
It's not, no. It's not. It's very much a kind of revisionist reimagining, kind of, and many other words with more syllables than are necessary. No, it's kind of intended to feel very contemporary and kind of modern, whilst also being set in that kind of medieval world. But the costumes are all very they're kind of recognisable as being oldie worldy, but they're also, you know, there's also like there's jogging bottoms in there, and you know, it's kind of, it's cool. It's a sort of mismatch.
Yeah.
Thing. It's going to be really cool. I think it's quite a cool cinematic language we've kind of developed for it.
All right. Obviously, we're not here to talk about Robin Hood.
No, but, sorry. Yes, of course. That's completely jumping the gun.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Next time when you're in for Robin Hood, we'll talk about your next project.
Yes, exactly.
Beyond that.
We'll always have one in the bank then.
Precisely. So, but here's one thing I do want to know. So you're about to start. It's your first day. Do you know, is it a tough day? Is it a dialogue day? Is it an action day? Yeah. Are you prepped? Are you ready?
I'm ready. My first day is a day of me and Jamie Foxx being kind of bromantic and bountiful.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
Have you done the bromance chemistry
test
with him yet?
That very well-known test in cinema? Yeah, well, I've done it. We've done it and we passed. No, I think we did a rehearsal yesterday that went really well. It's very exciting. It's going to be fun. Anyway, on to
Sing. Sing. Yes. Sing. That's what we're here to talk about.
Have you seen it?
Yes.
Did you like it?
2 months ago. Loved it.
Good,
fantastic.
Good.
We had Garth Jennings in on the podcast last week.
Yeah.
Or yesterday by the time we're doing this. And he was actually on the podcast the whole thing for the full hour. He was part of the podcast team. During that time, he told us an amazing story about how when he first went into the recording booth with Tori Kelly, he took his jumper off and he proceeded to take his entire t-shirt off as well by accident.
Oh no.
So therefore he was left bare-chested and directing this young lady
in front of the ever so cool soul singing phenomenon that is Tori Kelly.
In the semi-nude. Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't do that for me.
Oh,
I would
man.
Have loved it. He looks like he's been in the gym. No, he didn't do that for me.
No, he. Well, I think, and, you know, Garth was saying he looks like someone who's walked past the gym.
Oh, bless him. He's so wonderful. He's kind of, self-deprecating in the extreme. He's been amazing on this. And obviously, you've met him, you've had him on the podcast.
Yeah.
He's the most kind of, I mean, effervescent is the word I would use to describe Garth. He's kind of full of life, isn't he? And and fun. And
very quick as
very
well.
Very quick and witty and has a great sense for what is funny. Kind of perfect to helm a kid's animated movie about singing animals.
So what's that experience like for you, the experience of going into a booth? Because I assume this followed the standard animated movie procedure of, I'm in a movie with Reese Witherspoon and Matthew McConaughey and I'm not going to see them.
I've never met them.
Ever.
Yes, exactly. No, you're quite right. It was exactly like that. We all met and came together for the first time to promote it at the premiere at TIFF in September at the Toronto Film Festival. And it was kind of incredibly surreal because you spend these sort of hours in isolation recording these things separately. But in a way, there's a kind of fun and a kind of magic to it because you perform your own small cog in the machine that is the movie and then you get to see it all come together. And it's kind of like a big sort of a big singing Christmas present.
So you play Johnny.
I do.
A singing gorilla. Now, I don't think I've seen too many of those in
movies
before.
No. We're pushing boundaries. This is innovative territory. So I play kind of one of the... It's largely set in a kind of undisclosed American, city. You don't know exactly where, I don't think, unless that's escaping me. And I play a young British teenage gorilla whose dad is a bank robber played by Peter Serafinowicz. And basically Johnny has this kind of secret passion for singing that he's hidden from his dad, and his dad is trying to get him to be the getaway driver for his gang, and Johnny's just not interested and wants to pursue this creative passion of his, and it's his commitment both to the singing competition organized by Matthew McConaughey's character and what is required of him as the getaway driver for the gang that leads to problems because they start to conflict.
I found that storyline very interesting.
It's a fun storyline.
And it's intriguing because this is obviously an animated movie. It's aimed at families. The film is more realistic, obviously.
Yes.
It doesn't work out nicely for everybody
involved. No.
But I find it interesting that one of the main characters in this movie is actively perpetrating bank robberies.
I know.
I mean, trying not to.
Yes,
but
exactly.
Still
yeah.
doing it.
Yeah.
That was very interesting to me.
Yeah. And also, I think, you know, I think there's something about that. It's actually very, very, very relevant. That and something that I think a lot of young people will identify with, that feeling of not necessarily being completely aligned with your parents
yeah.
and what they want you to do versus what your calling is, as it were, and what, you know, your heart tells you you should do. So it's kind of good, I think. It's a good message for children.
Yeah, absolutely.
Without getting too worthy about it.
The message for children is: if Peter Serafinovich asks you to rob a bank,
don't do it. Yeah, quite right. And I've heard that happens a lot.
He does go up to people and just go, "Oi,
yeah,
oi, do it.
Get in the van."
Did you act with him at all?
No, I've never met him.
You've never met Peter Serafinovich?
I know, it's a weird old process. I've never met him, and I guess, you know, because he's a supporting role, he hasn't been out on the sort of, you know, the junket treadmill with us.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm sure I would have done. I'd love to meet him. I'm a big fan of his, you know, prior to this. So.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. I just assume that whenever you make it in the film industry, that it's like the Freemasons.
Yeah, exactly. And everybody, you all meet each other. You all hang in a room. No, it doesn't work that way. No. I presume you've met him.
I've met him, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
No, I think you're the Freemason, I would imagine.
I'm like the Kevin Bacon. I'm at the center.
6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. Yeah. You're at the center of the 6 degrees. Sure.
Yeah, it's just me. And I'm the nexus of the film universe. And everything spirals out from me.
Yeah.
But enough about my ego.
Yeah, I know. Wow. Whoa there. That was an insight into the mind of Chris Hewitt. Exclusive.
Listen, I'm a humble guy. I've just got a lot to be humble about. So, the singing in this, was that daunting? I mean, this is weird because I imagine you recorded this before you did Eddie the Eagle with the soundtrack.
Yes, it would have been a similar time.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So we now know that you can sing.
Right, yeah.
It wasn't that you were hiding your light under a bushel necessarily, but this must have been a very, very different situation for you.
Well, yeah, I did. I mean, I did that credit song with Hugh for Eddie the Eagle.
Yeah.
Which was a kind of an Easter egg and something that, you know, when Matthew asked about doing it, I said, great, but I don't want to shout it from the rooftops. I think it's more fun as an Easter egg, you know.
Yeah.
With this, there's no escaping it. The movie is called Sing, so yeah, I guess this is more of a revelation of the fact that I enjoy singing. Whether I've passed the test is I guess to be decided. But it is something I've always loved. I think there is a culture of singing in Wales, or there certainly was during my growing up. And I always was involved in like amateur musicals and things, and then when I was at drama school in your third year, when you do performances for agents and casting directors and the general public, every person is sort of given their big role, their meaty role, and then you play supporting roles for the rest of the year. And my meaty role was the lead in the musical. So I've always kind of done it.
Oh, right. Okay.
But I've never, frankly, I've never been paid to do it. So this is a new experience, but one I've enjoyed immensely. And like, I really have some great snatches of songs to play. To play with, and then my big number at the end is a great
you've song. A big number at the end, which in fairness Garth gave away in the podcast last week.
Oh, okay, so, fine, it's I'm Still Standing by Elton John.
We can talk about that. And it's on the soundtrack.
Which is out now, available from all good record stores. Sorry, they don't exist, do they? It's out now, available on iTunes.
There are some good record stores. The record stores still exist.
Oh yeah, no, I collect vinyl, so I'm aware of
them. Oh, do you?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Okay, I just got a vinyl player for Christmas.
Nice. I got one for someone for Christmas.
Oh really?
Yeah. What did you get?
I got my wife bought me I think it's pronounced Teak or Tiak.
Oh, this may be slightly too obscure. Yeah. And
she went to an audio store near where we live, and she said, I want to buy something good for my husband. God knows why. And they went, here, this is very good. Please now give us money. It's really, really good. It's like a proper hardcore thing.
And what was the first record you played on it?
First record I played on it was Leon Bridges.
Lovely.
His album, Coming Home.
Lovely. Lovely.
You know that record?
Huh?
You know that record?
I know. Is there a song called Shine? Or there's about fifth on that. I know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, Shine On. I think.
Shine On.
Yeah,
that's a lovely song. Yeah. Yes, I know that. I can't.
It's
I
good,
haven't listened to it.
It's a good record. What are you listening to at the moment?
What am I listening to at the moment? I'm quite into my hip hop at the moment. So Run the Jewels, Tribe Called Quest.
Okay.
J. Cole.
Yeah.
And then I'm kind of always flicking back to the classic stuff: Otis Redding, Sam Cooke, Drifters, okay. David Bowie, that kind of thing.
Elton John.
Elton John, I'm a big fan of Elton John as well. Of course,
Elton John. And you're singing Elton John in this movie, I'm Still Standing.
Yes.
Classic karaoke track.
Uh-huh.
Was it difficult to get the grips with?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a big scene. You know, it's not one you can sort of rest on your laurels with. You've got to go for it, and particularly in the context of the film, and the point at which he sings it in the movie, it's the moment to really go for it. You know, so having not really sang in a recording studio before, other than that credit song for Eddie the Eagle, it was quite nerve-wracking. And there's that, you know, when the first sort of half an hour, you're constantly terrified your voice is going to crack and it's going to be horrifically embarrassing for everybody. But thankfully that did not happen. And it's kind of, I'm very proud of it, actually. It sounds okay, I think.
Have you met Elton John?
I have. Yes, a couple of times. Yeah. You're being very Machiavellian here. I know exactly what you're doing.
No, I'm trying to tiptoe around this without giving stuff away.
It's too late for that, Chris. You've tried tiptoeing and you've stuck your big welly in it. Elton John is in Kingsman 2. Yes, he is.
How was that experience?
It was great, yeah. And as you quite rightly say, I think, like most people, I mean, he was a real icon for me growing up, and someone who I absolutely love, and someone whose songs I can, lots of them recite off by heart, I think. And he was an absolute delight. He's a very friendly guy, and he's great. He's absolutely amazing in the movie. So he really went for it. Super cool guy.
I'm very intrigued. He's a strange replacement for Harry Hart.
He is a strange replacement for Harry Hart. You're quite right. You're also playing dumb. I know you know more than you've got the inside scoop on Kingsman. Listen, I know.
I'm sure we both signed stuff that we cannot. people will kill us.
NDAs directly from Mr. Vaughan. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a terrifying situation. But when you saw Elton John, did you tell him that you'd sung this song that you were doing?
He had to sign it off, so I think he knew. Well, David certainly knew, I think.
Garth told us an amazing story about how David's office was the most fragrant-smelling place he'd ever been to.
Yeah, I can well believe it. They're a couple of immaculately turned-out guys, those two. I can well believe it.
Has it been tough? I mean, when you're thrust into the spotlight the way you were with a movie like Kingsman, which was a huge hit around the world, has it been tough? Frankly, not becoming a giant arsehole.
Yes, there's a compliment in there, Chris.
There is a compliment.
I don't think so. I think it has never felt like a chat. I don't know. I've got to, you know, I know the things that are important to me in life, and I know who is important to me in life, and the things that make me very happy, and they aren't. Those things aren't glitzy parties till 5 a.m. in LA.
Yeah.
They're fun, don't get me wrong. They are really fun. But I sort of short bursts of them. And then I like to go home and be with the people do I sound worthy and earnest? I think I do a little bit. It hasn't been hard to be sucked into the world of it all too much. But I don't think anyone is. I think people have this perception of like this showbiz world, like you say, like the Freemasons that you get initiated into.
Yeah, precisely.
But it's not. We all go home and we're all hanging out with our families and our friends. You know, we're not all, it's not...
I think it's like John Wick. It's like there's a subterranean world where you just descend through
like
level
a subculture
after level.
Of people who've all been on the front of Hello, all partying,
and
when everyone else is in bed.
It's Peter Serafinowicz.
Peter Serafinowicz is there.
He runs
Taron
it all.
Egerton because they've been in a film together.
And that's precisely it. But it is interesting. I mean, not just the stuff that you've done, but the stuff that you haven't done, because you've been choosy in a way. I mean, I know you've flirted with giant blockbusters and haven't gone for them
and that's but then you know there are things that you know like I'm about to embark on this new version of Robin Hood and my dearest wish is that it be a big blockbuster. That's what everyone's hoping for it, but for whatever reason I can't really quantify why I haven't decided to pursue or why I've turned down certain things, but it, by and large it's been because it's been a very instinctive decision that something, whatever the reason, has just been, no, that's not right for now. I don't believe that, you know, and it's largely about what I think will make me happy. And some things I've just thought, wow, that would be so much fun. But I also think there'll be a lot that comes with it that I will really not enjoy. And for that reason, I've just decided to pass. And actually, I haven't really regretted it yet. There hasn't been anything that's really, I've then seen and gone, wow. You know, there's been plenty of things that I've desperately tried to get and haven't that have, you know, I mean, that's just, but that is the name of the game. You can't really have regrets and you can't read blogs.
Never read the comments. Never read the comments. It's a bad thing to do. All right, Taran, it's been a pleasure. I'll let you go off back to your final collection, back to the hip hop.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, man. Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Typical Chris, he leaves us, but he can't quite leave us. Okay, time now for some lovely movie news, which will be an escape from the fire and brimstone of real news, we hope. What was the big story this week? Well, there were several, right? Should we
start with really small things?
Let's start with the small things. Let's start with the smallest thing of all. Jacob Tremblay of Room has signed up to star in The Predator.
He is the Predator.
We hope so. No.
How old is he now?
He's perhaps 10.
I think, yeah, he's about 10, maybe 11. But in our hearts, he'll always be a cute little five-year-old. I don't know. It's the youngest they've ever gone with this franchise, isn't it? I don't remember any children.
That was a proper what the headline spot, wasn't it? You're like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think it will just be Predator in a room, locked in a room with Jacob Tremblay for like 2 hours?
For many years.
My money's on the kid. Yeah. Honestly, he'd be great. I'm really glad to see he's getting work in high-profile films, and I hope it's a good part. Mm. He was phenomenally talented, and also his photos from the sort of the Oscar world, the red carpets and everything, were just the most charming. I'm glad to see he's still working hard in Hollywood. That's good. Also, Thomas Jane has signed up for Predator as well. Don't know much about his part either, do you?
No, not a thing.
But I don't know, I liked him in Deep Blue Sea. I quite like him fighting man-eating beasties. So, you know, could work.
Yay, more casting please. I really want to see that film. I'm fascinated by it. Absolutely fascinated by it. I mean, obviously terrified, but equally fascinated by it.
Why, just because it's Shane Black coming back?
Yeah, because it's Shane Black and it's Predator, and these are two amazing things, and they're back together again, and this is exciting to me. I'm watching it in that kind of slow motion, you know, where two cars are heading towards each other. Is this going to be an amazing near miss, or is it going to be a huge fatality? I don't know. But I'm very excited to find out.
Maybe it's going to be like in Fast 7, where they just crash into each other, but then they get out and they keep fighting, and it's awesome.
But I think that's almost certainly what will happen. And the Predator will pull an iron bar out of the sort of wheel well.
Yes.
It'll get...
Still excited about the fact that you remember a little while back Shane Black did a podcast Q&A with us, and he revealed a character name from the film, and it's such a good name, Quinn McKenna. Quinn McKenna. That's just a beautiful action movie name, isn't it?
I mean, it's no Stack of Pentecost, but it's it's pretty good. Quinn McKenna. Helen, what country is it where you, like, when you're choosing children's names, you have to pick from basically a list, like a set list? There is a set list of approved names, you can't deviate from it. This is a thing. I've not just made this up. It's not some weird fascist dystopia that I've invented. I'm fairly certain it's like Germany or something.
I think it might be I think in France there are certain names that they just won't let you have. And we know somebody who was turned away, whose parents were turned away in, I think, Canada when they tried to call her Stick.
Well, that's just good sense.
And that was, and they were told to go away and sober up and come back in the morning with another name. So I think it does happen sometimes.
Well, my point is, we should set up a country where you can only use action hero names, and you have to pick from a list, like a name generator. You can pick a first name, you can pick a last name, and they have to be like Jake Bullitt,
Johnny Utah, yeah. Stacker Utah,
exactly,
and Johnny Pentacles.
Exactly.
Okay.
That.
This could work, you know. We were speaking of monsters. Michael Dougherty has signed up to direct Godzilla 2. So this is obviously the follow-up to the Gareth Edwards film. And he is now on board. So the deal originally was for Dougherty to co-write, but he's now apparently going to be overseeing it as well. He's the guy who made Krampus, which we're quite big fans of.
Krampus is great.
So big, big step up in scale for him, though.
Yeah.
Big step.
I mean, it's exciting. I think I'm more excited about Godzilla versus King Kong, which is, I think, 2020. I think that comes
really?
Up after. Yeah, come on. It's like...
Really?
It's like... we all remember how... You know, Aliens versus Predator was so great. So there's no reason to believe this won't.
My whole thing with this is just that King Kong doesn't stand a chance. I mean, it's just he is toast before he gets even within 100 feet.
I mean, literally toast.
He will be incinerated with radioactive breath. I mean, I was going to say a monkey. He's not a monkey. He's an ape. But I'm going to call him a monkey.
How dare you?
The librarian.
Would not be happy. Yeah. there's also news about another quite big film this week. Star Wars Episode 8 now has a subtitle. The Last Jedi.
Yes.
So, tell me more.
Well, I mean, that's pretty much the news, isn't it?
It's the definite article followed by a kind of temporal qualifier and then a noun, like an important noun that we've heard before. I mean, it's all very exciting. I am actually the worst. I left the office early that day. And me and John were talking on text and stuff, and I was like, "Oh, can we do this? We've got to get this done." He was like, "Yeah, I'm just writing up a story on the new Star Wars title." I was like, "The what?" I was like, "Leave the office for 10 minutes, and the world like ends." So exciting!
It is exciting. Now, this is a phrase that was used in the crawl last time to refer to Luke Skywalker.
Yes, it was.
So but, that would be the obvious.
Yeah,
Yoda, but of course, mentions Luke as the last Jedi as well, I think.
Yeah, the last of the Jedi.
Last of the Jedi.
Yeah, but obviously Jedi is also the plural.
That's right.
So it could refer to Rey and Luke, or Rey and Luke and all their happy friends.
Now, what we really need here is an official announcement in Spain or France of the name. I'm not kidding.
Because it'll give you... But then, yeah, I suppose that's...
Because it will either be El Último Jedi, La Última Jedi, or Los Últimos Jedi. And once we have that, then we know.
Wow.
Then we know.
This is linguistic geekery on a level I've never encountered before.
Thank you.
Amazing. But maybe, as... Because Pablo Hidalgo, the keeper of the Holocron, has a penchant for fucking with people. And he... I mean, you see the stuff that he was tweeting afterwards, like he was tweeting comics and all sorts of stuff that clearly had nothing to do with anything. But I suspect it wouldn't be beyond him to purposely misdirect with the foreign language title.
True. But that's why I'm waiting for an official announcement. Yeah. Like in Spain at the moment, they're calling it El Último Jedi, but I don't think it's coming from Disney themselves or Lucasfilm themselves. So,
It's exciting. It's where we knew it was going, isn't it? I mean, it's like you've got proto Jedi, you've got old school Jedi. There was clearly going to be some Jedi-ness going on. The last Jedi-ness, and then I just don't know what this film's about. It's killing me. It's actually killing me.
Well, it's about Luke Skywalker and General Leia and, Rey and Finn and Poe. Probably a love story there somewhere. Let's go with Finn and Poe. It's going to be good.
I mean, it is just... I mean, I can't think of anything else where the title gets you this excited. Like, I changed my wallpaper to the logo of the film. I mean, that's just...
It's amazing the power, isn't it? Like, the Lucasfilm press release was literally, like, two paragraphs. Yeah. And one of them was just information we already knew. Like, it's directed by Rian Johnson, it's produced by Kathleen Kennedy. And the world exploded. Over this one little press release.
Every Star Wars announcement is just a massive intergalactic mic drop. They just walk in and go, "The Last Jedi," boom, we're out.
Yeah.
And you're just like, "Oh my God, give me
Did
more."
You see Rian Johnson's Instagram feeds the other day? He put up a photo from his editing suite and it had...
The crawl
with The Last Jedi on episode 8 The Last Jedi. Yeah. And that little sort of behind the scenes goodness, it just sends shivers down your spine.
You just think, scroll up. You want to hold your thumb over it like it's a live picture on your iPhone to make it animate. That's what you want.
Yeah, that's going to happen, James. Yeah. That'll definitely work. Can we not joke about worlds exploding, please? It's a little too close to the bone. It's exciting. And what do we think about the red title? Does that have a meaning? Apparently that was the case for Return of the Jedi.
Yes, Jedi was red.
As well. We can't call it Jedi anymore. It's confusing.
That hadn't crossed my mind
there
as
you
well.
Go.
You can't call Jedi anymore.
Well, yeah. We could call The Last Jedi last... But
that just sounds silly.
Call it the.
Oh no, this is not good. Right now, that's a whole new wrinkle.
You've turned your back.
No, that's it. I'm done.
Level.
Well, because like title words, so obviously, because Empire is traditionally white, isn't it? The logo for that. Mm-hmm. And then, you're right, Jedi's red. This interesting. What do the colours mean? What could it mean? Nothing.
I like the theory that this is a sentence, these three titles. So, The Force Awakens, The Last Jedi, and then Episode 9 with a nice cup of hot chocolate.
That's really funny.
I don't know.
It amused me.
Well,
but what does it mean? Because we put an article on the website about some theories.
Speculating.
I mean, there's an element of finality to this title, which suggests that there will be no more Jedi in future Star Wars movies, and there will be a Star Wars movie every year forever.
What
does it mean for the franchise?
I don't think it's necessarily a kind of a forward-looking thing. I think it could be he is the last Jedi, as he's been referred to in the past, and they have now found him. They have found the last Jedi. Or she is a new Jedi, and he dies at some point, spoiler, and she becomes the last Jedi. But then she can make, she could train other Jedis. There could be other Jedis that come later. Yeah. So, you know.
So, yeah, yeah. It could be. I think it's backward looking as well. Like, he is currently the last Jedi, but that doesn't mean there will be no more Jedi. Yeah. But, of course, she will have to do some pretty sharp persuasion, presumably, to get him to train her, given the disaster last time he trained somebody and that guy murdered everybody, including his best bud. Hello. Yes. I mean, at least he, you know, remained, like, really well coiffed, but like apart from that, he's like thoroughly bad now, so that's worrying.
Because remember, Yoda was once the last Jedi for a brief period after Obi-Wan Kenobi died.
Yes.
So, you know, there have been other last Jedi.
I mean, there was a joke on Twitter going around that episode 9 would be titled, "Oh wait, there's some more Jedi."
No, it'll be episode 9, "There is another."
There you go.
Fingers crossed. And we should also probably get to the big news of the week, shouldn't we? Which is the, well, two big things. There's a new Empire, right? Which we'll talk about in a minute.
Mm.
But also the Oscar nominations were announced. And my favourite, La La Land, got 14 nominations, which equals the record held by All About Eve and Titanic. Hot on its heels were Arrival and Moonlight, which both had 6. There are, you know, the fair spread down the list. You've got Hacksaw Ridge with, was that 3? Hidden Figures, 3 as well. Fences did quite well. So, what do we think about this shire of... I'm sorry, what do we think about this list?
I absolutely adore La La Land. I've seen it twice now, so... And I liked it more the second time. I fell in love with it a little bit more. So I'm totally happy with this 40 nomination sweep. It's a safe set of nominations, I think. I think there's nothing too challenging. There's nothing that was hugely surprising, but it's a good set of films. I think the Best Picture nominees are all pretty strong. I mean, somebody said in the office the other day that the lowest Empire have rated any of these Best Picture nominees is 4 stars. So they're all good films. I think... there are some notable snubs.
You think?
I'm not going to say who, but it rhymes with the Shmamy Shmadams.
I mean, can we just talk about that for a second? What the actual... what happened there?
Seriously.
What happened there?
One can only assume that her own vote was split between Nocturnal Animals, which shouldn't have been nominated, and Arrival, which should have been. I genuinely don't understand it otherwise. Makes no sense to me.
It's maybe something to do with the Academy's love affair with Meryl Streep, who was bafflingly nominated for Florence Foster Jenkins.
She's very good in Florence Foster Jenkins, but that is not a film that should be in this conversation. And obviously, you all know, if you've listened to the pod from, 2 weeks ago, my view that Emma Stone should not have been nominated for La La Land, not because she's not delightful, but because there is no part there. So I would put Amy Adams into one of those spots. In a heartbeat. I would actually also consider Kate Beckinsale for Love and Friendship, which I think is a hugely underrated film that's been completely overlooked here. And actually, Chris emailed me to say, can I please mention that he is outraged about Oscar snubs to Hunt for the Wilder People, obviously, Love and Friendship, particularly for Tom Bennett, as well as Kate Beckinsale. Daniel Radcliffe, he thinks, should be up for Swiss Army Man, which was never going to happen, but I love your optimism. And Hugh Grant, because if we're nominating people for Florence Foster Jenkins, then he should be in there as well. So I wouldn't massively disagree with any of that, except maybe some of it.
And I believe Hugh Grant was hotly tipped as well, according to Emma, who is our...
he'd been nominated in a lot of the critics groups. He was obviously up at the Golden Globes. So yeah, that was a bit of a surprise. I was also surprised, a couple of surprises, animated feature film, no nod for Finding Dory, nod for Your Name, controversially.
Okay, Finding Dory should not have been on that list. Sorry, John.
Come on.
It's resoundingly average.
Resoundingly average.
That may well be true, but it is not a great film. My whole thing with this is what really bugs me about animation is Zootropolis is clearly, I'm going to call it Zootopia. Zootopia is clearly going to win, and it shouldn't.
It's very good.
It is not worthy to polish Kubo's katana.
I agree with that. But yes, I don't know. I would personally be rooting for Kubo. I was really interested actually as well to see that up for visual effects.
Yeah,
which is I think fantastic
animation.
Because it's a mix of stop motion and VFX around the edges, yeah. And it's wonderfully done.
It's glorious, isn't it? Like the end credits when they show you the skeleton sequence. Like,
oh my goodness!
And you're just like, I these people are my gods. It's such an effective film. It's like Moana. Like Nick and I argue about this because it was one of his favorite films of last year. Moana's great, but I think it's great because the music is amazing. I think the film itself is a little bit pedestrian.
Which brings me neatly to Best Song. What the hell is going on with Best Song? First of all, only one nomination for Lin-Manuel Miranda and Moana. I mean, there were three very eligible songs in that film, and they should all be up there. Second of all, nothing for Sing Street. Are you kidding me? This is an outrage. I cannot bear it.
What's your pick for Best Song?
Oh, it's probably going to be that stupid La La Land, City of Stars nonsense.
It really is.
And the fact is, that will stand in the way of Lin-Manuel Miranda's EGOT, at least for a year.
I know.
And that is not something that I am prepared to countenance. And also, it's just not that good a song. I'm sorry. Come on. I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
No, you're really not. It isn't that good a song. It's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But all of the songs in Moana are better than it.
All of the songs, like, by a substantial amount.
I don't know about that. I don't know.
Frankly, it should have been the track listing from Moana from top to bottom, ending with Shiny, which should have won.
Yeah, Shiny, you're welcome, I think, should have been nominated over How Far I'll Go.
I Am Moana is actually one of my favourites from that.
It's great.
Because I think it takes everything from Where I'll Go and makes it better.
Yeah.
So.
But it's too short, probably.
Yeah, it is short.
It's just, and honestly, Sing Street, I mean, I was listening to some of that again today on the way in, and what are you thinking?
The thing with Sing Street, and I think the thing with a lot of these films, like Hunt for the Wilder People, they're too small. They're too small, and you have to have, with a lot of these films, you need an awards budget. Like, part of the marketing is you actually need to send screeners to Academy voters. You need to put adverts in the trade papers. You need to make a big song and dance about it and promote your film as an awardsy sort of film. Sing Street probably isn't in that realm, unfortunately.
Yeah. Now, I spoke to Phil the Groundhog yesterday, by which I mean Emma. Emma is our Oscar prognosticator. Not that you're not, Helen. Because you're very good at this stuff. Emma is a freak of nature and does kind of Oscar's money ball. And
she's like Rain Man.
And it is alarming how accurate she is with a lot of this stuff. And like, she wrote down her list of what she thought the nominees would be, and she got maybe two wrong. Yeah. I mean, it was stupid. So we have a list here of what we, and by we I mean she, think will win. Should we just run through some of the big ones here, and you can tell me what you think? So picture, she's saying La La Land.
Blah.
Without a doubt. Yeah.
Hooray.
She's not wrong. Director, she's saying herself. La La Land.
Hooray.
Actor, she's saying Casey Affleck. I think that's a fairly decent shout.
He's certainly been in the lead. Yeah. Denzel may be making a late push there. And if more comes out about the, or if more kind of builds up about
the wholeness that we probably shouldn't talk about,
allegations, but, then Denzel could nip in.
Yeah. We're saying actress, Helen Clojure is Emma Stone for La La Land.
I'm genuinely pulling for Natalie Portman, who I think is extraordinary in Jackie. I saw Elle yesterday, and my God, she's incredible.
Yeah, and remember, she picked up the Golden Globe. I mean, that's not a huge indicator, but there is a big wave for her at the moment.
I would like to see, I would be very, very happy with Hooper and Nega or Portman in that category.
It's a very strong category.
Supporting actor, we're saying Mahershala Ali for Moonlight.
Yeah.
Which I think is fair.
Which is fair, although I'm really pleased to see Michael Shannon. I know you didn't like Nocturnal Animals.
No, but I love him.
He was extraordinary in that film, and I would love to see him.
He's one of the greats. I'm very happy to see him in there.
Yeah.
And can we all agree on Viola Davis for Fences?
Who on earth would quibble with Viola Davis for anything?
That sounds absolutely fair, especially if you have read Ollie Richards' interview with her in the previous issue of Empire magazine, which, to be fair, is a really great interview. And it's very important that I state here that is nothing to do with Ollie's ability as an interviewer, and it is entirely down to Viola Davis being awesome. So
you continue the worst.
Yes,
James.
Indeed. Original screenplay, Manchester by the Sea.
I would not argue with that. I think it's an extraordinary film, but that, again, that's an incredible category apart from La La Land. Lobster, it's brilliant to see that nominated, but it's the nomination is the win in that case.
Yeah,
I think
definitely.
So yeah.
And then adapted screenplay, we're saying Moonlight again.
That's a strong category, isn't it? Arrival, Fences, Hidden Figures, Lion, and Moonlight. That is a heck of a category. probably Moonlight. I wouldn't rule out Arrival there, which, by the way, didn't get nominated for visual effect, and no less a personage than Paul Franklin, aka, you know, Christopher Nolan's visual effects guru. That was the one that shocked him about that kind
of thing. And rightly so. And actually, that really wound me up, because it made me think that there was a lack of education in understanding that category in that case, because almost all the effects in that film are invisible. Not all of them, but most of them. And if all you do is watch the kind of making of footage that shows the environmental suits, it should win for that. Like, I didn't believe that they weren't wearing those suits when I was told about that. I had to be shown the actual production footage of that. I was just like, invisible effects are incredible.
They are, yeah. But I think that's probably why Deepwater Horizon is up as well, because I think a lot of the effects there are invisible, because they did build essentially an oil rig for that film.
Yeah.
So everything then around it is invisible.
Animation.
Yay.
No. Editing, La La Land.
Probably.
That's an important one, by the way, because I think Emma said that, you know, you have to win editing to win Best Picture.
Generally, you have to be nominated for editing to win Best Picture. Right. Apart from, there was one exception in the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
But you have to have a nomination, and you usually, have to win.
So
not
look out
100%.
On the nights. If you see them, if you see La La Land win editing, then it's probably going to have a good night.
Cinematography, production design, score, costume, sound mixing, and song. All La La Land.
I mean, a costume actually is the one that sticks out there. I don't think they've entirely nominated the best films this year. Where's Hail Caesar in that category, for example? But I think Jackie's a better costume film there.
Interesting.
Actually.
Why does makeup only have three? And, why is that a thing?
And why does makeup have those nominees?
Well,
you know,
it's... But why only... I don't understand. Why are we discriminating against makeup? Is this...
I don't know.
That strikes me as an odd one. Visual effects, honestly, if the Jungle Book doesn't win, I'm walking out.
I loved Doctor Strange's effects. I thought they were really artistic and gorgeous.
Yeah, to be fair,
that's a strong category.
They're the most creative use of visual effects in Doctor Strange. I thought it was something I'd not really seen with CGI before, which is quite a rare thing to say.
The Jungle Book, to me, though, was the film that showed me how far CGI had come. Like, I watched the film and I thought, I genuinely didn't think this was quite possible, like, to look like this. I mean, it was like when we saw Rise, Dawn. Which, what's the second Planet of the Apes? Is it Dawn or Rise? I never get this right.
Dawn.
Like that one, when I saw what they did in situ in the forest, that was incredible. And this, to me, was like another one of those, oh, wow, moments that you normally only get with James Cameron movies, where you're just like, oh, we can do this now. Incredible.
And Gravity.
Yeah, and Gravity was that for me. Gravity was another one. But for me, Jungle Book needs to win that.
By the way, I'm hosting the VFX Festival again this year in early February, and they're going to come along and do some breakdowns of how they did some of these films, and I cannot wait.
Awesome.
If anybody is out there is into VFX, come along and have a look. It's going to be amazing.
And beyond that, the other ones we had down, Emma thought Star Trek Beyond is likely to win hair and makeup, and she thought Hacksaw Ridge would take sound editing.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Apparently, and this really, really bugged me. So for score, the lack of arrivalness on there really rubbed me up the wrong way. But then someone pointed out that it might not be eligible due to reusing elements.
Yes, apparently that's the problem with it. I have to say, I'm kind of hoping for Mika Levy there for Jackie. Jackie has an incredible score. I would really like to see that one win.
We should also just very briefly mention that Suicide Squad is now an Oscar-nominated
The Oscar-nominated Suicide Squad. And lest we forget, the twice Oscar-nominated Passengers, and I think we can all agree this redeems my 4-star review in full.
I mean, but you know, Oscar nominee Norbit, and Oscar winner 360 Mafia,
and Oscar winner Fisher Stevens. Just throwing
that
out.
So, you know, there's room for all sorts within the Oscar family, I suppose. But yeah, the Oscar nominations, the Oscar ceremony will be held on February 26th. Obviously, Empire's crack team will be up all night live blogging the entire thing and going slightly insane from lack of sleep, so you don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
Do look out for that. We'll be keeping you up to date on all of the big award ceremonies between now and then. We should probably move on to sadder news now. The news broke last night as we record this that Mary Tyler Moore died at the age of 80. She was, of course, an Oscar nominee, star of films like Thoroughly Modern Millie and Ordinary People, which obviously got her Oscar nomination. She starred in David O. Russell's Flirting with Disaster as well, but she was best known for her work on TV, which was incredible. She was kind of genre and era defining on the Dick Van Dyke Show, first of all, and then her own The Mary Tyler Moore Show, set in a newsroom kind of sitcom, with Ed Asner, who paid tribute to her this week by saying that she turned him into a feminist. I mean, just there was an absolute flood and outpouring of love and respect to her in the wake of her death. She basically has shaped the careers of virtually every woman working in television and film, as well as many of the men. She redefined the era with that sitcom. I saw loads of tributes last night about how well written it was and how incredibly structured
this
it was.
This is the thing, and when people put together their best TV lists, and I'm sure we've been guilty of it, and it's, oh, The Wire, oh, The Sopranos, it is generally held that The Mary Tyler Moore Show is one of the best TV shows ever made.
Yeah.
And a lot of younger people don't necessarily appreciate it.
It's hard to get in this country.
Very hard. I don't think you can get it in this country.
Yeah, I was looking for it last night to watch some, and I couldn't find it. So, it's a shame that we can't. Hopefully, it'll come on Netflix or something. Maybe in the wake of this, there'll be a little bit of an upsurge. Netflix, if you're listening, please get on it. She was something of a legend. If you saw, I posted a clip on Twitter last night of Oprah's producers got Mary Tyler Moore in as a surprise to Oprah when she was talking about her, and Oprah like basically burst into tears and couldn't speak for 5 minutes. That's the level of fame and reverence that this woman had, and all credit to her. So Mary Tyler Moore died aged 80.
Also, Gordon Kay died this week.
Gordon Kay, star of Hello, Hello, which, again,
Renee.
I mean, it's not a big or a clever show, but it was so clever at the same time. Listen very carefully, I would say this only once.
I just hope that he was interred with the fallen Madonna with the big boobies. I think, really, if he wasn't, then that was a missed opportunity.
With all respect to him, that was definitely a career highlight for him. Yeah. And you know, he will be much missed.
What I always find funny with that is, like, you look at things like that and Fawlty Towers and stuff, and I mean, do they still get played on, like, UK Gold, or is that even still a channel? Or is the massive casual racism something that maybe makes them less inclined to screen it? I don't know.
Oh, it's still there?
Is it? I haven't seen it on TV in years. But I'm sure it has aged gracefully.
Me too, but I can still quote most of the lines from it, obviously. What are you doing with that girl in your arms? That was sad news. Shall we pick things up again?
Yes.
With the news that this is New Empire Week.
It is New Empire Week.
And, like, I have to say, without wishing to blow my own trumpet,
but you're going to,
this is the Helen O'Hara issue of things Helen O'Hara really, really likes of Empire magazine. So we have Hugh Jackman's
20-page feature on Supernatural.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm fighting for that. That's going to be the 2018 issue of things Helen really likes.
Quadruple fold out Dean and Sam.
Just Dean, thank you.
Spread.
First of all, we have our cover feature, which is Logan. Which is Hugh Jackman and I. We just sat down to breakfast in a fancy hotel.
It's just Hugh and I. That's the name of the feature, isn't it?
Yeah, basically.
By Hugh Helen O'Hara.
He's explained basically what he was thinking with this new film. We went to the edit bay in Los Angeles, where James Mangold showed us about 50 minutes of the film. It looks stunning, what I've seen already. I just hope that the rest of the film lives up to it, because I think if it does, we are looking at something really, really, really special.
And you also get to read how Daphne Keane calls Hugh Jackman a massive C unit, and I think it's worth reading just for that.
She does, in Spanish, because she's bilingual. So in things I didn't write, which is much better news for anyone sensible, we profile Christina Ricci, who's returning to TV, and that is extremely good news. We report on The Great Wall, the giant Chinese-American co-production that you've probably already heard a little bit about, and it looks incredible.
Nick embeds himself in Kong, and that wasn't supposed to be an Ace Ventura gag.
No, he really does.
He really does. Like, Nick went to like three continents following this film around. He was in Vietnam, he was in New Zealand, he was in, where was the other place? I mean, Hawaii.
Australia.
I mean, he was basically in the film. He's just like,
basically,
he was part of the crew.
There's some really good anecdotes as well.
Oh, it's amazing. It's really like a travelogue. And I mean, I don't think anyone has ever got this kind of access. So you will never, ever read a Kong feature anywhere else like this.
Yeah, that's true.
So definitely have a look at that.
Definitely look at that one. And we went back, we went over the Resident Evil series as number six finally approaches.
This is really, really awesome, by the way. Like, people are going, oh yeah, Resident Evil, whatever. This genuinely is amazing. This is Simon Crook talking to people about like the great moments from throughout this franchise, and it is batshit crazy. It's brilliant. That might be my favourite thing in the issue.
I mean, Resident Evil makes literally no sense, but I kind of enjoy watching it just with my jaw dropped, going, what the hell is going on?
You see, I've never, ever seen a Resident Evil movie.
Oh, you've got to watch this.
I think it's the
second or the third one where there's a line saying that the virus dried up the rivers. I mean, it's incredible. it's just like nothing else. We've also got Lego Batman.
Yes, we do.
Will Arnett profiles all the other attempts at Batman that are less good than his. And then we have a 24-page tribute to Carrie Fisher. I got to write about Princess Leia, which is another one of my favourite things. But we have tributes from people who knew her. We have an excerpt from her book, The Princess Diarist.
I will say, incidentally, if have both of you read The Princess Diarist?
Not yet. All the way through.
Don't buy the audiobook, because she narrates the whole thing and she's just magnificent. It's definitely one that you want to listen to. Amazing things in here. Dan Aykroyd wrote an incredibly touching tribute. I mean, it really was absolutely heartbreaking, the last line of that.
It's really sweet, though. What was her nickname for him? Was it like Turtle?
Tuna Neck.
I mean, it's so sweet, because they were, you know, briefly engaged at one point.
They were, yeah. And then she left him for Paul Simon.
Yeah, it's quite a story.
Yeah, it is. And we've also got some like gorgeous pictures of her that you probably haven't seen before. Yeah, I certainly hadn't seen all of those. We've got a report on Postcards from the Edge and her writing. We've got her, Carrie Fisher, in her own words, because honestly, what's the point of having anybody else's? That's really, really wonderful. It's a great tribute to her. And just when you get into it, we also have all the other usual bits in the magazine, you know, the cinema reviews, the at-home reviews, where I got to talk to Taika Waititi about Hunt for the Wilder People. I told you it was my issue full of all my favourite things.
It really is.
First looks here at Journey's End. We've got a look at Personal Shopper. We've got just Chips. I mean, I think we're all excited about that one. The Love Witch, which you really need to know more about.
A little film called Justice League.
I don't know if anybody would have heard of that. I don't know if it's worth mentioning.
It's just very low budget indie that's trying to.
Oh, it's got that superhero with a trident. What's his name? Tuna Neck. Also, Sally Hughes talks about Star Wars. Which is definitely worth reading.
Yeah, so honestly, even if we do say so ourselves, this is a seriously good issue, and you should pick it up. It's a good one. Okay, it's time now to review this week's films. This is a huge week for cinema.
Isn't it?
It's really, really big. Where shall we start? Given that we had Taryn on earlier in the show, shall we start with Sing? So this is from last week's pod host, Gareth Jennings, directing. It is an animated film set in a city where animals live, basically, so a little bit Zootropolis in that sense, but only in that sense. And it is the story of a theatre owner called Buster Moon. He's a koala voiced by Matthew McConaughey, which is just not a sentence you hear often enough. And he's on his uppers. He's desperate to make some money, and he comes up with the idea of a singing competition. So then we get to meet the wannabes, the hopeful contestants who come to join this singing competition. We've got Reese Witherspoon as an overworked pig with 25 children. We have Taron Egerton, as you heard, as a gorilla belonging to a criminal family who just wants to sing. We have an elephant who's so shy that she's not sure she can really sing in front of an audience, but who has the voice of an angel and also of Jennifer Hudson, which is pretty much a synonym. And it's just sort of their stories. It's madcap. It's funny. It's charming. I think it suffers a little bit by comparison to Zootopia, just because Zootopia was so clever about what it would be like to live in a city with all of these creatures of all of these different sizes. And this doesn't bother with any of that nonsense, for the most part.
Yeah. I think was Neil Olcott, The Incredible Suit, maybe tweeted, or I saw somewhere maybe on Letterboxd, that he said, I wonder if the people who made this movie went and saw Zootropolis halfway through and thought, ah, damn it. because it is very similar. And I think Zootropolis does it in a slightly cleverer way. Like, it creates this world of mammals,
yeah.
Which is, you know, a sort of city designed for animals, a bit cleverer and a bit more interesting.
Yeah,
whereas Sing doesn't really go into that.
I mean, this would not be substantially different if they were all people.
Yes, yeah. You know? They don't really make as much of a thing out of the animals. They just are because it's cute.
And it is charming. And it is super charming. Yeah.
Hashtag merchandising.
Oh, so cynical. But yeah, it's really, really charming. The music is great, as you would expect. Some interesting songs in there, as well as all the pop hits.
Yes.
You know, which Garth talked about last week. And we gave this 4 stars. All right, let's go on to the big sequel of the week, T2 Trainspotting. 21 years, because it took them a while to edit it, and they had to shuffle around filming schedules. 21 years after the original, we rejoin the Trainspotting gang. Renton, often now addresses by his first name, which is confusing, Mark, has been living in Amsterdam, and comes back to visit the old stomping ground, where we reconnect with Spud, Ewan Bremmer, who's still kind of struggling with addiction, struggling to
taking pleasure in other people's leisure.
Well, that's very good.
Thank you.
For you. Yeah. And Simon, aka Sick Boy, who is running a failing pub and also has a nice sideline in blackmail. Meanwhile, Begbie has been in prison for pretty much the whole of the last 20 years. But he's about to escape. Spoiler. So what do we think of this one?
I really enjoyed this, actually. I think there's a huge... It's funny, there's a lot of films coming out about this time which have a similar sort of thing, revisiting old franchises from 10 or 20 years on. And there's something a bit Force Awakens about this film in a weird sort of way.
Yes, that's fair.
Do you know what I mean?
The Smack Awakens.
The Smack Awakens. Yeah, because it's a film which is... very much sort of enamoured with its own mythology, and it's aware that it has a bit of a cultural status, you know, that these characters have become quite enduring and that people know the original film quite well, and so it does play on that a little bit. And, you know, there are moments which I think you could describe as fan service, but I think it's also quite clever about it in some ways, and I think it works. What's interesting is these characters are also kind of enamored with their own mythology, and so that sort of plays into this narrative that they are sort of pining for their youth, for this sort of the more carefree days when they didn't have the worries that middle age brings, I guess.
And also I think that's entirely true. I think they're pining for the youth and trying to figure out what they are now that they're not young guys with nothing to lose. I agree that it plays on its own past. I think it does so too much for me. I think, you know, there were not just story callbacks and flashbacks, but there are, you know, visual callbacks all over the place in terms of like shots and poses and effects and everything else. And I just felt like a lot of what we loved about Trainspotting back in 1996, and the reason that all of us, an entire generation, had the poster on our walls and the soundtrack in our CD collection, is that it felt new and fresh and different and unlike anything we'd seen before. And this one is so concerned with paying homage to the original sometimes that it forgets to bring us that influx of something new. And we know Danny Boyle still has it in him. It's not like he's played that out. So that was my major sort of hesitation with it. Like, I wanted just something a little bit more than this was. And maybe that's unfair. Maybe it's unfair to expect that of a film 20 years on with the same characters.
I think the issue is the same thing that we have, in that the filmmakers are not immune to that same sort of like fuzzy hygge feeling nostalgia that we are. Like, I, you know, when these things are revisited, these things from my childhood, from my teenage years, or in this case from when I was at university, hashtag old, I get all warm and fuzzy thinking about it. And I think these guys too, a lot of them haven't seen each other in ages, haven't worked with each other in ages. You know, Danny Boyle and Ewan McGregor certainly haven't. And, you know, you do kind of regress a little bit and you want to relive the old times. That's where you end up with, in the same way The Force Awakens was kind of a greatest hits package, they're trying to hit all the emotional and thematic touchstones to resonate with the audience that loved it the first time. But weirdly, maybe possibly missing the point, as you say, of why they loved it the first time. But
But it is emotional. I mean, there is something quite amazing about how sad this film is. It's kind of heartbreaking. You know, none of these characters are in a great place when we meet them again. And they are still making terrible decisions. And, I mean, it's got a sort of melancholy about it, mixed with that same quite crude, anarchic sense. I mean, there is maybe the most disgusting suicide attempts I've ever seen on film, which really has to be seen to be believed.
But even that, and I'm not going to spoil exactly what I mean by this, but even that is a bit of a callback to the original.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? So I felt like even that was a bit, okay, you've done this already. Do something else.
Yeah.
So, I mean, sometimes it worked really wittily. So, the original film obviously started with Ewan McGregor pelting it down a street, trying to escape security guards. This one opens with him pelting on a treadmill. That's funny. That's clever. That shows the passage of time. But there was so much of that kind of piled up. But great performances, I think, from all of them.
Yeah.
Ewan McGregor was worried about getting a Scottish accent back, but he did, obviously. Yeah. It is not a bad film. So this is 3 stars for T2 Trainspotting. All right. Next up, Mel Gibson's return to Hollywood's good graces.
The doesn't really work, is it? Gibsonescence.
The Gibbs erection.
The Melturn. Yeah, it's not going to work.
No.
It is the return of Mel Gibson, however, with Hacksaw Ridge, which is the based on true life story of Desmond Doss, who was the first conscientious objector to win the Medal of Honor. This is not a spoiler. This is history. In World War II, despite being a devout Seventh-day Adventist and refusing to touch a weapon, he volunteered for the U.S. Army and was sent to Okinawa, where he took part in the Battle of Hacksaw Ridge. He wanted to be a combat medic. He still had to go through basic training. He refused to carry or touch a gun during basic training, which resulted in the Army's attempts to court-martial him, letting him serve. And when he got to the war, he distinguished himself heroically, basically. He's played by Andrew Garfield, with Hugo Weaving as his father, support from Vince Vaughn, Sam Worthington, and more. What did you think of this, John?
I liked it a lot. It's a really impressive piece of work. I mean, we know that Mel Gibson can direct the hell out of a movie, and he really does. He's quite a classical, old-fashioned sort of filmmaker. He directs things in a very, in a sometimes quite broad way. I mean, this film is a film of two halves. It's kind of quite similar to Full Metal Jacket, in that the first half is about the training camp and him sort of coming to terms with his military service, and also a sort of history of violence in his family, and of confronting that and his faith. And then the second half, we move into World War II and into Okinawa and the heroics that come from that. And it's big, broad, sweeping cinematic, stuff. And I think in the first half, that feels a little bit cheesy for me. There's some sort of slightly saccharine moments where he's courting a lady, which I'm not sure was maybe necessary.
Yeah.
But some of the stuff in the boot camp is really strong, and I think there's some really good, like, meaty moral quandaries that you can get your teeth into.
Yeah. I think it's a real risk, that structure. I mean, I guess that the story demands it, but Kubrick did it really well, and I think Full Metal Jacket is a more subtle and a more, it's a better film. This is not, we should not say this isn't good, but that's a better film, and therefore you're kind of setting yourself up for comparisons that are hard to live up to, I think, with that structure. I agree with you. I mean, this is Mel Gibson in sort of Braveheart mode.
Yes.
I mean, he is really good at that. This sort of epic, broad strokes, quite old-fashioned Hollywood biopic, I think, and that's sort of the approach he's taken here. It's probably a little bit more historically accurate than Braveheart was, but then, so is this podcast. I mean, like, seriously. So
I did feel that the strokes could have been slightly less broad at times.
I agree.
I think there are moments where it feels like you're being sledgehammered with messages. I mean, the final act of heroism as Desmond Doss saves all these people from the battlefield. He's painted in such a sort of Christ-like way.
There was a literal Christ pose at one point.
Yes.
I was like, dude, we get it.
Yeah.
Like, seriously.
And I mean, they really really, really ram home the point that he is a hero. You are under absolutely no doubt. And you could just do with maybe a little bit more subtlety in the approach in some places. But it's an extraordinary piece of work. And, you know, we've seen war depicted on film so many times, but it's still quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
The way that they shoot some of these battles, it's brutal and visceral and shocking.
Yeah, it is very, 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 very effective in the war scenes. We should also say, I mean, Andrew Garfield is great in the main role. Some of the accents around him sometimes slip. I mean, you can tell this was shot in Australia and that they're all playing Alabamans. But he's really committed. He absolutely sticks to it. It's a fascinating thing as well, just to contemplate. He's been nominated for Best Actor, obviously, for this performance and not for Silence.
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting because, for me, Silence is actually the tougher performance and probably by a nose the better film, but it's interesting that both films are entirely about Andrew Garfield's faith, but coming at it from completely different angles.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really interesting double bill that way once these two come out on DVD or something.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. But we gave this 4 stars, so Hacksaw Ridge 4 stars. That is a recommendation, and it does appear that Mel Gibson is back. There are 2 other films this week which we should talk about fairly quickly because I realise we're running out of time. Christine stars Rebecca Hall as the news anchor Christine Chubok, who killed herself live on television. This is a true story. It happened in 1974. It's one of 2 films about this incident that are sort of coming out at the moment. Kate Plays Christine is due out, I think, here later this year, I believe. But this one sees Rebecca Hall as the reporter herself. She's kind of struggling in her personal life. She's envious of her mother's new romance. She's has a sort of unrequited love for her fellow anchorman George Ryan, who's played by Michael C. Hall, no relation. And she's also just more and more upset by the way that her news station is going. Basically, they're prioritizing lurid sensation over real news. She's feeling unappreciated as a journalist. I mean, this is not something that anyone nowadays can relate to, of course. But it just builds and builds and builds to, obviously, the tragedy that, I mean, it can't be a spoiler to say that because she is known for that one reason. So it's a really incredible performance from Rebecca Hall. Genuinely, it's I don't know if this wasn't eligible for this year's Oscars or if it just was overlooked because it's a small film, but honestly, phenomenal performance from her, drawn out by director Antonio Campos. And it's a very thoughtful film, actually. It's worth a look. It takes in sort of issues of sexism and journalism and integrity and, you know, depression and loss that are still incredibly relevant. And so we give this 4 stars. Also out this week, which I certainly haven't seen. Have you seen it? Is Denial, which I'm afraid I haven't seen yet. We give this one 3 stars. Great cast. Timothy Spall, Rachel Weisz, in the story of a Holocaust-denying author played by Spall, who sued the Jewish academic who accused him of being anti-Semitic, and she was forced to prove the existence of the Holocaust in court. So fascinating, meaty stuff, but perhaps a little bit small screen.
I remember when this happened.
Yeah, me too. Mm. This only got 3 stars, but that is a recommendation. So it's a heck of a week for film.
Indeed.
All right, that's it for this week's podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we will be joined by Matthew McConaughey to talk about goals.
All right.
That's what I was going to say. You stole my line. Ah.
To be fair, it was incredibly first base for both of you.
It was
the most obvious. Just keep
thing
living,
to say.
James. Just keep living.
Yeah.
Until then, it's goodbye from James.
The Last Jedi. That's what you must now call me.
No. And it's goodbye from John.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to join a march against the best song category. Do you hear the people sing, Street?
Oh, God.
Singing the rest of Moana. It's going to happen, I'm telling you. See you guys.